Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We're going to talk in just a minute. Time me, 60 seconds, to George Packer, New Yorker staff writer, who you may know from his reporting on the Iraq War, but who has a fascinating article in this week's issue called The Fall of Conservatism. But before we get to George Packer, just want to remind you that we are in the home stretch of our spring membership drive. This will all wrap up on Thursday. So if you have not yet made a contribution to WNYC this year, we hope you'll make your once-a-year pledge right now. Our phone number, just so you have it, you can use it, feel free to use this phone number at any time, 1-888-376-WNYC, 1-888-376-9692. Or pledge online at WNYC.org. And we have a new contest, which everybody who is already pledged is automatically entered in. And anybody who calls or logs on and hopefully pledges will too. And that is a trip to Tuscany, courtesy of Bloomsbury Auctions, a trip to Tuscany for two. So there you go. Join WNYC, renew your membership, support the station, and maybe you'll even win a trip to Tuscany. Now, my first guest is the New Yorker correspondent, George Packer. And if you think that means we're going to talk about Iraq, well, this time you're wrong. Yes, Packer covered the war for the New Yorker and wrote the much-acclaimed book, The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. But in this week's issue, he's got a really in-depth look at the national political climate in an article called The Fall of Conservatism, Have the Republicans Run Out of Ideas? Hi, George. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. It's good to be back with you.
And before we go to the big picture, you have some historical shockers in here that I didn't know about before. Here's one. Pat Buchanan admitted to you, did he tell you this directly, that he once advised the Nixon campaign to distribute bumper stickers in black neighborhoods, pushing the idea of black politicians for president or vice president as a way to alienate white Democrats from the Democratic Party. Did I get that right?
You got that. He gave me a memo that he wrote. He gave me a copy of a memo that he wrote in 71 in anticipation of the 72 presidential campaign, which is sort of a laundry list of ideas for splitting the old Roosevelt coalition into its different parts and peeling away parts for the Republicans, Southerners, white working class voters, Catholics, groups that, you know, are still very much with us and very much in play this year. Buchanan's memo is a kind of a blueprint for how Republicans could take away core pieces of the old Roosevelt coalition. And although they didn't act on every suggestion, it was a pretty successful strategy.
Did they go through with the bumper stickers or anything at that? Because he even said that the Republicans should do everything in their power for 72 to see a black person nominated for at least vice president at the Democratic convention, according to your article. Talk about exploiting racism.
Well, you know, I haven't found any evidence that the Republicans were behind Shirley Chisholm's presidential campaign that year. And I don't think they acted on that particular aspect of the Buchanan memo. He sent it to me with a little cover note saying it's a little raw for today. So I think he's aware that it smells bad, it looks bad, it was bad. But Buchanan is basically proud of the role he played in the creation of the new Republican majority, which was what Nixon was all about in the 68 and 72 elections.
And to the bigger picture and bigger point of your article, or one of the big points, you have Kevin Phillips at that same time advising Nixon to polarize the American people in general on purpose for political gain. And Phillips called it at the time positive polarization.
Right, and that's a phrase that Vice President Spiro Agnew also used, and it, Buchanan said to me, was, you know, what we were all about. That's what the Republican campaign strategies of 66, 68, 72 were all about, and they were remarkably successful, and in a way they came at a moment when America itself was so deeply polarized over all the upheavals of the 60s, and we sort of forget that the mass movements of the 60s did not just consist of students, civil rights, black power activists, etc. It also consisted of a white, mainly white populist reaction to the campuses and the cities and Vietnam. And that's what Nixon was able to exploit so successfully by talking about law and order and appealing to the great silent majority of Americans.
That phrase of his, silent majority. So flash forward to the beginning of the Bush administration in 2001, but before 9/11, and you have Karl Rove and Dick Cheney strategizing to relentlessly push the idea of red state and blue state America rather than unite the country after the Bush versus Gore tie, essentially. Did that have its roots in Buchanan and Nixon?
I think there is a fairly direct line from Buchanan, Nixon, Agnew, and Nixon circle to Lee Atwater, who was a young Republican during those years, and Karl Rove, who was also a young Republican during those years, to the early Bush presidency in 2001, which was a real reversal of the way Bush had run. And this is one of the most interesting things that that I found. It's in a new book by the former Rhode Island Senator Lincoln Chafee, who points out that just after the Florida recount was ended by the Supreme Court, Dick Cheney met with five moderate Republican senators and, according to Chafee, told them, there's not going to be any bipartisanship here. This is going to be confrontation and division and polarization between red and blue America and between the U.S. and all the countries that are, quote, against us. Just one second, Brian. I have to put the phone away for one second.
All right. I think family...
I'm alone with an eight-month-old at the moment.
Family obligation. Well, you know what? We're coming to a break anyway. So when we continue with George Packer in a few minutes after he changes the diaper or whatever he's going to do, and by the way, later in the hour we'll be talking about organic and non-organic infant formula, and the organic label may not give you the benefits that you think in all cases. But when we continue with George Packer from The New Yorker, we'll talk about the other shocker in his new article, The Fall of Conservatism, having to do with William Buckley handing over the reins of National Review based on religion, and then talk about why he thinks all that is in decline. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer with stay-at-home dad and New Yorker correspondent George Packer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, thanking all of you. We've had a nice little outpouring there already this morning. We thank all of you for your support. And we continue with George Packer from The New Yorker, author of the book on Iraq, The Assassin's Gate, which won him a number of prizes and lots of acclaim for his great reporting over there. Now he's turning his attention to the national political scene. His article in this week's New Yorker is The Fall of Conservatism, Have the Republicans Run Out of Ideas? And George, as you heard a few minutes ago, is also home alone with his eight-month-old. How's he doing, George?
Help has arrived, Brian. This is going to be a better conversation from here on.
So I said we were going to come back with the other shocker for me in your article. The first one was that Pat Buchanan suggestion from 1971 that the Nixon campaign actually distribute bumper stickers in black communities suggesting black politicians for president or vice president just to alienate white Democrats. The other one was a revelation about William Buckley that he declined to make David Brooks his successor as editor of National Review because Brooks wasn't Christian. When did that come out?
That came out last year in a piece by Sam Tannenhaus of the New York Times and the Times Book Review, who's writing a biography of Buckley. I think he found a memo in which Buckley and George Will discussed who should, you know, be the successor at National Review, and Buckley said it should be a believing Christian, which implied that it wasn't going to be David Brooks or David Frum, both of whom are Jewish. And, you know, some conservatives didn't express any surprise at this to me that, you know, of course National Review would want a Christian. Buckley's conservatism was founded on not just Christian but Catholic orthodoxy in many ways. But I found it a sign of sort of intellectual insularity, and it was replicated at Commentary when Norman Podoritz's son John was handed the editorship. I think it was about a year ago. John Podoritz you know, is a vigorous New York Post op-ed columnist, or he was, but he's not at the intellectual level. His writing isn't at the intellectual level of the old commentary. And it just seemed that whether it's, you know, doctrinal purity or blood relation, these two leading publications of the right had become insular and had kind of hardened and walled themselves off from new ideas. And one point that several conservatives, including the editor of National Review Today, Rich Lowry, made to me is that these publications could not see what was in front of everyone's nose, that the Iraq war was being lost. And they refused to write that for several years.
So this is the heart of your article, really, that you have lots of Republicans, including David Brooks, including Buckley's actual successor at National Review, Rich Lowry, I don't know which church he attends, including David Frum, who you mentioned, who also wrote for National Review and who also wrote the Axis of Evil speech for President Bush, all kind of admitting to you that movement conservatism, as we've known it, Karl Rove conservatism, if you will, is dead or dying. What exactly is dead?
Yeah, David Frum said to me, the movement as a cohesive, self-conscious thing is dead. In other words, there really is no longer a group of people who are acting in concert to introduce conservative ideas into institutions of government. That reached its high water mark with Reagan. It began to become radicalized and also, I think, corrupted during the Gingrich delay years, and George W. Bush has presided over its crack-up. And the more thoughtful and far-sighted conservatives know that absolutely in their bones. And in fact, I was kind of stunned as I went around talking to these people by just how dark their view is of their movement and of the Republican Party, which harnessed itself to their movement. They all said that they expect Republicans to be routed this year, and that almost there was a sense that they deserve to be routed this year, and that if John McCain happens to win the presidency, it will be, as Rich Lowry said, by default.
But how dead is it? I mean, these quotes that you have are really interesting and really telling, considering their sources. But I hear the big conservative talkers on the radio, like Hannity and Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham, sticking to pure movement conservatism and hammering McCain for being impure almost as much as they hammer Obama. And, you know, they still get their ratings. They're still dominant in radio.
Brian,
so how dead is this movement?
You know, you heard liberal interest groups at one Democratic convention after another demanding that the candidate, you know, be pure on their issues for decade after decade while Democrats lost elections. New Deal liberalism, I think, began to be eclipsed in 68 with the election of Richard Nixon, but it was decades before the Democratic Party sort of accepted that a new era was with us and that it was a conservative era and that liberalism would have to change itself in order to survive. And I think it's going to take years for these conservatives, especially the ones who've made a very fine living off, you know, being the self-appointed commissars of the conservative movement, to accept that their movement has gone into eclipse. The reaction to my piece has been furious in some quarters, and I think it's partly because the piece really relies on conservative voices to make this point. So there's a sense of
What reaction? What are people saying?
Well, Michelle Malkin mocked it. The New York Sun immediately published an editorial saying how silly it was for liberals to keep counting conservatism out over and over and to be proved wrong over and over. Well, it's true that liberals have been sort of waiting for the conservative era to end, maybe, you know, ever since the election of Jimmy Carter, and there have been a lot of false dawns or false evenings. But what these conservatives who I interviewed said to me is this is more profound than simply an election cycle. This is both a movement that's run out of ideas, partly because of its own success. I mean, partly because many of their ideas became mainstream political thinking, but also because the world has changed, and small government and low taxes are just not the answer to the key problems of today. And the smart, younger conservatives know that, and they're trying to this very difficult task of moving, you know, this massive thing called conservatism in a new direction that answers problems of today, not the problems of the 60s and 70s and 80s.
My guest on WNYC, George Packer from The New Yorker, his article this week, The Fall of Conservatism, Have the Republicans Run Out of Ideas? And, yeah, that large point that you make that Karl Rove Republicans have been denying even the existence of some major issues today that actual swing voters, mostly white working class swing voters, care about. Wage stagnation, they tend to deny it. Income inequality, dismiss it. Global warming. And here's Karl Rove on Fox News Sunday, this very week, 2 days ago, on how to revive the party. And he addresses this point of the issues people care about.
Strategically, they better get their act together with an aggressive agenda of reform here at home about the things people are talking around the kitchen table. What are the Republicans going to do about health care? What are they going to do about providing reliable and affordable energy? What are they going to do about jobs and keeping our economy innovative and competitive, encouraging exports? What are we going to do about helping people grapple with the cost of college education? We've got great answers, Republicans do, on this, but they better get their act together and laying this out in a comprehensive way.
Brian, can I comment on that?
That's why you're here, George.
That is a wonderful little soundbite. I mean, he uses the third person plural, they. Who was the domestic policy advisor for George W. Bush for much of his presidency? Who was the leading political advisor for George W. Bush? His party had the White House and Congress for the better part of 6 years. Where were they when all those issues were becoming so important at the kitchen table? It's just remarkable that Karl Rove has transformed himself into a sort of helpful critic of the Republican Party, having wasted the chance for 6 years to do something about these issues he's now urging others to do something about.
Karl Rove pundit. And now McCain is walking that line, and that's another interesting part of your article, trying to figure out whether he's the antidote to Rove or not. And he, you know, to my eye, kind of wavers between Bush conservative rhetoric and something postpartisan, or as you describe it, possibly pre-culture wars, pre-1960s.
Yeah, David Brooks said he's a pre-60s figure. He missed the 60s. And I think that's true. And I asked his speechwriter, Mark Salter, about, you know, will McCain make an issue of the hot button matters of the culture wars like gay marriage and abortion? He said, you know, he's just sort of embarrassed to talk about those. Those are things that someone of his age, you know, just doesn't talk about. And, you know, there's a sort of a code of honor that McCain has, or at least that he seems to have, you know, that you don't, you know, you don't get elected with Rovian tactics. They were used against him in South Carolina, and
right.
He was deeply bitter about that. But he is sort of going all over the map right now. It's hard for me to understand his strategy. One day he's talking about appointing Supreme Court justices in the mold of Alito and Roberts and Clarence Thomas. And the next day he's giving a speech in which he's sort of imagining a world without the Iraq war, which looks very much like the world that Barack Obama is talking about. So
And we're just about out of time. We've just got a minute, George. But you say if McCain is a pre-culture wars figure, Obama is setting himself up as a post-culture wars figure. And, you know, yet I'm sure the culture wars will still motivate some turnout. What kind of election campaign does that make between a pre-culture war figure and a post-culture war figure?
I think that their supporters and advisors are going to be pulling them back toward the campaigns of the 80s, the 90s, at least some of their supporters. But the candidates themselves, I think, are the best positioned from both parties to have a campaign based on issues. And right now, they're calling each other names, but at least they're calling each other names over whether to talk to Iran, which is a completely legitimate campaign issue, rather than over the flag lapel pin and other arcana.
George Packer, New Yorker correspondent, his book, The Assassin's Gate, on his Iraq war experiences. And I want to mention that the play, based on some of his Iraq war reporting, remember George Packer was here to talk about his play recently, and it's still running. This is a longer run than we expected, George,
it's
right?
It's like The Mousetrap in London. It'll be with us for days. It'll close June 16th.
Oh, really? June 16th.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, you better get to Culture Project.
That's called Betrayed, running at the Culture Project through June 16th. George Packer, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks to you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up in a minute. When is organic infant formula worse for your baby than non-organic? Stay with us.